This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Harvard professor Danielle Allen is jumping into the race for governor. She plans to make it official tomorrow. Allen is hoping to become the first woman and the first Black woman to be elected to the state's highest office. She has never held elective office. Earlier today, she told WBUR's Anthony Brooks that she's running for governor to address the stark inequalities around housing, transportation, schools, and justice that were laid bare by the pandemic.
We saw plain as day when the pandemic hit last winter that it was a completely different experience for people in the knowledge economy and people who were in the service economy. And the bottom fell out from under for people in the service economy. We were not really ready to reconnect people to opportunity and security. And as you talk to people now, the pain is still just visceral about that experience.
So Allen joins fellow Democrat and former state Senator Ben Downing, who jumped into the race in February. Her announcement is just the latest in a host of news stories about what might happen in the race for the state's corner office. So we want to get the lay of the land as things start to heat up. To do that, we have WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, welcome back.
Hey, good to be here, Tiziana.
So there's a lot to talk about here, Anthony, but I know you spoke with Danielle Allen today, just as you did a feature on Ben Downing recently. So let's start with her. Give us a sense of who Danielle Allen is.
Right. Well, no experience in politics, as you mentioned, but a really impressive academic resume. Danielle Allen is a political theorist at Harvard, where she directs the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics. She's also a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant. And when she was just 30 years old, she's 49 now, she was a dean at the University of Chicago, the youngest dean ever there. So she's got real sort of academic chops. Another interesting thing to point out about her father served in the Reagan administration, and she grew up as a conservative Republican, but she went through a kind of political awakening and transformation some years ago and is now running as a progressive Democrat. And about her lack of political experience, she points out that there are many precedents for this, including right here in Massachusetts, with people like Deval Patrick and Elizabeth Warren, who were political outsiders, but who jumped into high-profile political races and won.
So you guys actually spoke today. What did she tell you about why she wants to be governor?
Well, it gets back to this idea of inequality. She makes the point that while things are beginning to feel like they're returning to normal for a lot of us, she argues that's not the case for millions of people across the Commonwealth, where she says too many families really can't afford the basics. They suffer from things like food insecurity. And during the pandemic, Allen was involved in various efforts to develop public health infrastructure to respond to the pandemic. And she says in doing that work, the inequalities baked into our society became very apparent to her. And she says, while Governor Charlie Baker has been an able administrator, he hasn't addressed the root causes of inequality in Massachusetts.
The Baker-Polito administration has not tended responsibly to the basics, the building blocks of social infrastructure, housing, transportation, schools, justice. And from my listening to her, I can tell you there are a lot of people in this Commonwealth who do not think that that has happened and has been responsibly addressed.
Of course, we don't know, Tiziana, yet if Baker will run for a third term. But if he does, he's gotten pretty high marks for his handling of the pandemic and remains a very popular governor. So this is an uphill climb for anyone who wants to challenge him.
So we don't know if he'll run, but now we do have Danielle Allen. As we said, we have former State Senator Ben Downing. Give us a sense of how the Democratic field is shaping up, Anthony, and who else is eyeing, you know, entering the ring.
All right, we'll talk about Ben Downing first. So he was the first to jump into the race, announcing last February that he wanted to challenge presumably Governor Baker if he does run. He represented Western Mass for five terms as a state senator, then stepped down to run a solar power company. Downing, interestingly, is also focused on inequality. And last March, he told me that Massachusetts is a state with vast intellectual resources, enormous wealth, but also with very high levels of poverty and stark racial wealth disparities.
You know, the hope, the why is to build a fairer, stronger Massachusetts. The potential of Massachusetts is limitless. Like, we're within this state that is no larger from one end to the next than Silicon Valley. And yet to have those gaps makes no sense at all.
So that's former State Senator Ben Downing. State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz is also contemplating a run. And of course, the big question, Tiziana, among the Democrats is Attorney General Maura Healey. She has millions of dollars in her campaign account, lots of name recognition. And if she gets into the race, she'd probably be the front runner among the Democrats. But we don't know if she's going to run or not.
Really, to that point, as you say, she does have a lot of name recognition.
Yep.
National reputation, you know, she's battled the Trump administration nationally. She's known for her battle with corporations like Purdue Pharma. If she gets in, what does that do? Do other candidates have a shot, other Democratic candidates have a shot if she's in?
Well, anything, of course, is possible in politics, it seems, especially these days. You know, I think you're right. I mean, Healey would be the front runner. But look, as we know, being expected to win doesn't mean you automatically win. I mean, just ask President Hillary Clinton or Governor Martha Coakley about that, right? I mean, Maura Healey would be the front runner, and yet, you know, the other candidates, so that's a given. But the other candidates would have a shot against her, and I think it would be a mistake to assume otherwise.
So you have noted that Governor Baker hasn't said yet if he will pursue a third term. At this point, is he sort of the stalking horse, though? Does he remain the man to beat?
Oh, yeah, there's no question about that. I mean, Baker is well-funded. He remains very popular in the state. You know, he's figured out that secret sauce of running and winning as a Republican in deep blue Massachusetts. And, you know, it's always interesting to note he's more popular among Democrats than he is among Republicans. But among the things that are interesting about Danielle Allen's candidacy is that she's a Black woman at a time of historic change. In Boston, we're about to elect the first person of color to the mayor's office. This would follow Ayanna Pressley's election as the first woman of color to represent Massachusetts in Congress. So with regard to her campaign for governor, Allen told me today that it's taken more than 200 years, but we might actually be at a point where leadership can be open to everybody. So that's going to be a big theme in her race as well.
So let's jump ahead to the Massachusetts GOP, because they're having, it appears, a bit of an identity crisis of their own right now. And it seems that one factor at the core of that upheaval is Governor Baker and whether the Trump wing of the state party is behind him. Is that fair to say? And what does that do to impact Baker's chances should he choose to run for another term?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, clearly the Mass GOP is at war with itself. Baker's the moderate. He never embraced Donald Trump, so he doesn't have a lot of support from that hard right wing of the Republican Party. While the state Republican Party represents that hard right Trump base, and that includes lots of people who don't embrace Baker. But Baker's been able to more than make up for that by attracting moderate Republicans and lots of Democrats. So I guess the risk for Baker is that if he faces a strong challenge from a strong Democrat, he could lose enough of that Democratic support to put him in danger. And that's one of the big, fascinating questions that we're going to be following in the months ahead.
And so let's talk about Baker's vulnerability to a Democratic challenger. You know, as an analyst, if you were going to say how Democrats should be thinking about defeating this often proclaimed most popular governor in America, what would you say?
It's interesting. And I think they are thinking about it. I talked to a senior campaign advisor of Danielle Allen's today, and I think they recognize the challenge. The challenge is, and for other Democrats, is that they need to make the case that being a solid administrator isn't enough. Do enough Massachusetts voters and do these times demand the governor to do bigger things? You know, Allen is banking on the idea that the governor should do more than just run the government competently. But the big question is, do enough Massachusetts voters see the governorship that way? I mean, it's clear that lots of voters approve of Baker, but the big question is, do these extraordinary times call for extraordinary leadership that someone like Baker might lack, or, you know, that someone could make that case against him? If the answer is yes, then Democrats like Allen might be able to build a successful case against him. But, you know, it has to be observed and pointed out that Baker remains a very popular figure in Massachusetts.
All right. This is something to continue to watch, which we will do with you, WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks.
Hey, my pleasure, Tiziana.
The sea level around Boston rose 9 inches in the 20th century, and a sixth of the city is basically built on watery ground. The same ocean that has helped Boston grow and thrive, now it's a threat. And while the potential for calamity, you know, seems far off, the reality of that sea level rise is upon us now. A new WBUR series, Boston Underwater, which kicks off today, explores the issue of sea level rise, our vulnerability to it, and what's being done to mitigate it. WBUR environmental editor Barbara Moran is here with us now to tell us more about it. Welcome, Barbara.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Barbara, why this series now?
Well, as you mentioned, the sea level rise already has crept up around Boston about 9 inches in the 20th century, and it's getting faster, right? So we're looking at by the 2030s, another 9 inches. And if you go around the city, you can already see what's happening, right? Like Morrissey Boulevard, Long Wharf, they're already getting flooded at high tide. Roads are getting closed. And I think we all remember the big storms in 2018 that flooded the seaport and had, you know, dumpsters and kayaks going, you know, around downtown Boston. So this stuff is already happening and it's accelerating. And so we really need to think about getting ahead of it because there's still time to do stuff now.
So there's probably a lot one could cover in talking about it, especially with that sense of urgency. You kind of just made my heart race a little bit there.
Sorry.
What are the, yeah, no, I mean, for real, right? So what are the big problems you are going to focus on this week?
Well, I mean, you're right. It is, it, when you sort of look at the topic, it kind of gets overwhelming and you get the palpitation. So I have to say it was really interesting. My idea for thinking about this topic was really informed by some maps I saw that came out of UMass Boston, I believe, a few years ago. And they overlay the historical coastline of Boston with the flood danger area, right? And if you look at it, I mean, it's amazing because Boston used to be much smaller, as you mentioned, and has been built out over time. And the areas they built out are these ones that are really prone to flooding. And it got me thinking like how Boston is this really historical city and people like that about Boston, right? That's part of its charm. But it was built for a different climate and the climate's changing and this old part of Boston is not made for what we're facing now. So we started to look around at things that kind of fit that theme, or they're old things that are have to deal with climate change, have to move into this new climate. We thought about the subway system because we had the first subway system in the country here in Boston. And so we're doing a piece on the Blue Line and how vulnerable that is, you know. The stormwater system. We had one of the first stormwater systems and sewage systems in the country, which, you know, it's good for Boston, but now it's, you know, some of the pipes are, you know, 100 years old and we're still, they're not built for what's coming. So we looked at things that dealt with those old and new themes.
So I imagine in looking at something like this, you made some choices about what to cover this week. You've just taken us through those, but I'm guessing that there are things that were also fascinating that didn't make it into the series, but they're still with you. Tell us about those.
Yeah, one of the things we didn't focus on too much is sort of, there's a lot of really creative flood prevention measures being looked at for individual buildings and individual sites. And I mean, that's one of the things that's also in this old new theme. There's a lot of old buildings in Boston, which are not ready for sea level rise. Now people are thinking really creatively about ways to deal with this. And we touch on in our series, in our segment about the seaport, we talk a little bit about the Children's Museum, which has been there for a while and has these really creative plans to sort of build out this park marsh thingy into Four Point Channel, and a lot of other people are doing creative things. But we ended up not wanting to focus too much on individual solutions and look at things that are going to really need sort of citywide cooperative solutions and having different entities, private and public, sort of working together to solve them. Because I think that's, we don't want to make it look like, oh, don't worry, like this building can just, you know, put in some flood prevention and they'll be fine and da da da. Because it's not going to work that way, right? It can't be a one-off solution. It has to be citywide or even statewide.
So we're going to bring another guest here in a minute, but before I do, you know, you're passionate about all things related to a changing climate and environment. You know, it's your job, but also personally, what is it about sea level rise in Boston that is really getting you going?
Well, you know, I like Boston, right? Like you go downtown, you know, like all the old timey stuff. And like, I look at like Miami, right? And I don't know if you heard about this last week, Miami came up with this new plan, or they're talking about this new plan about to deal with sea level rise by building a like 6-mile, 20-foot $6 billion wall through the city. Wow. And it's like, yeah, you know, I don't want that. Like, I want it. If we figure out now, if we think about this now, we can get ahead of it. You know, like we can do things that could, you know, help the city and save it off. But it could be kind of cool. They could also add to the city and it could preserve the historic stuff. And, you know, like we don't have to have some huge, icky, expensive thing.
So kind of getting ahead of it and doing it in ways that enhance while also defending us.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Exactly, so Barbara, right. Stay tuned because I'm going to bring in another voice here, a voice you know. Paul Kirshen is a professor at the School of for the Environment at UMass Boston and director of the Stone Living Lab, which engages scientists in the community in research and education and climate adaptation. Paul Kirshen, welcome to you to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon. It's nice to be here.
So, Paul, you've heard us just now talking about urgency. How do you talk about the urgency in this issue?
You know, I've been talking about this for, I don't know, over 20 or 30 years now. So I sort of lost my urgency. I tend to come across as pretty factual because the facts themselves just convey the urgency. The fact that we've had sea level rise over the last 100 years because of climate change, it's accelerating, as Barbara pointed out. It could be 7 or 10 feet of sea level rise by end of the century, cause, you know, tens of billions of dollars of damage if we had a major storm to strike Boston mid to late century. So there's plenty of information out there about what a dire situation we're in right now, and it's only to get worse in the future.
So, Paul, you heard Barbara talk about the maps that got her interested, the historic maps. And I should note, there's a wonderful story with pictures of historic maps that show the changing landscape on our website at WBUR.org. What is the simplest way to explain how we got here, Paul?
Well, essentially, as we pointed out earlier, so much of Boston has been built on fill. And when they did this filling in the 1700s, 1800s, they just filled up above the present 100-year flood. But now, several has gone up, you know, a foot or so since then. And the 100-year flood is now going to overtop the built-up shorelines.
And so there's a new 100-year flood level, Paul, and it's higher than the old one, and it's higher than what we're prepared for?
Yeah, and so much of Boston was built on the old 100-year flood level. Just like the old sewer system was built on the old rainfall conditions. The coastline is built for the old civil rights conditions. So it's just like the rainfall conditions, we're very much out of date right now.
So, Paul, what are some big steps that we're already taking?
Well, I think, you know, Boston and this region, you know, recognizes the threat of climate change, particularly civil rights. So that is a big step compared to many other parts of the country. Also, as I've said many times, one of the most important things we have to do in dealing with climate change and sea level rise is control our greenhouse gas emissions. You know, if we can get these down to zero by mid-century, we're only going to have 3 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century instead of 7. It's a lot easier to manage 3 than 7 feet of sea level rise. So I think the city and the Commonwealth have set as, you know, a zero emission target by 2050. So that's a big step forward, because it makes the problem a lot more manageable. But because we really can't reverse climate change, the most we can slow it down, we do have to deal with, you know, continuous sea level rise and increased storms for centuries to come. And, you know, I personally think that and we've written on this, and the city has adopted this policy, the best approach to deal with rising seas and increased coastal flooding is to build up the shoreline, what we call nature-based systems. And these systems are like berms and parks and playgrounds that elevate the shoreline and also have tremendous co-benefits on them. So on the land side, there's a park or a playground. So this provides open space. This creates urban forests for cooling. And this creates tremendous benefits for a lot of communities like East Boston that do not have a lot of open space. And then on the coastal side, we can create habitat in the intertidal zone, which creates all sorts of ecosystem benefits. So these nature-based systems, by their elevation, they provide protection against increased tidal and storm flooding, They provide social benefits and they provide ecological benefits. And by the way, they're probably cheaper than traditional hard concrete structures. And there are other benefits as well. If I just say one more thing, the biggest benefit is we can build these up over time as we need them, because we don't know exactly how much civil rise we're going to face in the future. With these nature-based systems, we can build them up as we need them. We can build them up as the climate change occurs. So again, that's a huge benefit of these kinds of systems.
Thanks for that, Paul. So in our remaining time then, Barbara, then I'll turn back to you just for any closing comment you may have.
Well, I mean, I feel like the nature-based solutions, like the building out of, you know, the parks is really a great way to go. And we really need to get going on it quickly. I don't mean to laugh, but it's like, all right, people, you know, it's coming. And I feel like if we work now, we could have these really nice solutions that do really enhance the city and protect the city at the same time. So I hope that the series, you know, puts this idea in people's head and really brings that conversation forward.
All right. So that series is Boston Underwater on WBUR this week. WBUR environmental editor Barbara Moran and Paul Kirshen, professor at the School for the Environment at UMass Boston and director of the Stone Living Lab. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
So now we want to highlight some terrific reporting by WBUR's own Martha Biebinger. Martha's story on persistent comas in some COVID-19 patients who end up on a ventilator originally aired in July of 2020. Today, though, we learned her story won a Sigma Delta Chi Award for COVID-19 radio feature reporting, competing against radio stations of all sizes in all markets across the country. So we wanted to share her exceptional journalism with you by revisiting her piece, the story of one COVID patient from Wayland, Massachusetts, who experienced a persistent coma.
Leslie Katita said yes twice when doctors from a Mass General ICU called, asking if she wanted them to take extreme measures to keep her husband Frank alive. These conversations about whether to let Frank go or try some experimental drugs and treatments were in late March and early April. By the end of that month, Frank's lungs had recovered enough to come off a ventilator. But then Frank did not wake up.
It was a long, difficult period of not knowing whether he was really going to come back to the Frank we knew and loved. So it was very tough, very tough.
And prompted more questions about whether to continue life support. Leslie wrestled with the life doctors asked her to imagine.
If this looks like Frank's not going to return mentally, is that something that you and he could live with?
Every day, sometimes several times a day, Leslie Katita would ask Frank's doctors, what's going on inside his brain? Why is this happening? The candid answer was, we don't know. Dr. Brian Edlow is a critical care neurologist at MGH.
Because this disease is so new and because there are so many unanswered questions about COVID-19, we currently do not have reliable tools to predict how long it's going to take any individual patient to recover consciousness.
And more importantly, says Edlow, what their mental state will be if or when they do. This spring, as Edlow watched dozens of Mass General patients linger in this unconscious state, he reached out to colleagues in New York to form a research consortium. They're sharing data to determine which patients recover, what treatment might help, and why some patients aren't waking up.
There are several potential reasons for this, one of which is that we are having to administer very large doses of sedation to keep people safe and comfortable while they're on the ventilator.
Frank, for example, was on a lot of sedatives for a long time, 27 days on a ventilator. Edlow says some of these patients have COVID-related inflammation that may disrupt signals in the brain, and some have clots that have caused strokes.
So there are many different potential contributing factors, and the degree to which each of those factors is playing a role in any given patient is something that we're still trying to understand.
And how many patients end up in this prolonged sleep-like condition? Dr. Jan Klassen, a neurologist at New York's Columbia Medical Center, is part of the consortium working to answer that question.
In our experience, approximately every fifth patient that was hospitalized was admitted to the ICU and had some degree of disorders of consciousness. But how many of those actually took a long time to wake up, we don't have numbers on that yet.
Claussen says he's guardedly optimistic about recovery for some of these patients. A study he published and a recent case reported by Edlow at MGH show some patients' brains respond to verbal commands while they are unconscious. Leslie Katita says Frank eventually had a CT scan.
From what they could tell, there was no brain damage.
And then on May 4th, after 2 weeks of no signs that Frank would wake up, he blinked. Leslie and her two daughters watched on a screen, making requests, elated.
You know, smile, Daddy, hold your thumb up.
It was another week before the Katitas would hear Frank's voice.
We would all just be pressing the phone to our ears, trying to catch every word, and he didn't have a lot of them at that point, but it was just amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Frank spent a month at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. He's home now, doing physical therapy, but has no cognitive problems. The Katitas say they feel incredibly lucky.
Because at one point, this doctor said to me, if Frank had been anywhere else in the country but here, he would have not made it.
That doctor said virtually all of the patients in Frank's condition in New York, for example, died because hospitals could not devote so much time and resources to one patient.
And that's a conversation I will never forget having because I was stunned.
We did have an advocate.
This is Frank.
Who could have gone the other way and said, look, this guy's just way too sick and we've got other patients that need this equipment. Or we have an advocate who says, throw the kitchen sink at it. And we happen to have the latter.
But how long should hospitals suggest that families wait for a loved one to wake up? Many hospitals use 72 hours or 3 days as the period for patients with a traumatic brain injury to regain consciousness before advising an end to life support. Dr. Joseph Giacino, who directs neuropsychology at Spalding, says he's worried hospitals are using that 72-hour model now with COVID patients who may need more time.
We need to really go slow because we are not at a point where we have prognostic indicators that approach the level of certainty that we should stop treatment because there is no chance of meaningful recovery.
Frank Katita's 2-week return to consciousness is an example. Giacino urges all of us to be sure loved ones know how we define meaningful recovery in case there are difficult choices ahead. The message from Leslie and Frank Katita is pretty straightforward. Wear a mask.
This is nothing to be trifled with. It's an absolute devastating experience.
I'm not considering myself one of those, but there are many, many people that would rather be dead than left with what they have after this.
Researchers hope to have the first numbers on the extent of brain injuries that result from COVID, including after a prolonged coma, sometime this fall.
That report from WBUR's Martha Biebinger, and again, it originally aired in July of 2020. The first round of research that Martha mentioned was actually published in May. It took longer than expected. And it shows that 17% of patients hospitalized with COVID experience a coma. Researchers do not yet have details about how long patients linger, the extent of their neurological injuries, or about how many patients never regain consciousness. And an update from Frank Katita. Today he told Martha he just set a personal best on a 10-mile road walk and is back, quote, more than 100%, truly a miracle of modern medicine, end quote. We're going to take a break. Stay with us. Coming up, what does Juneteenth mean to you? We'll take your calls at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. It's been 13 years now since Massachusetts' first Black governor, Deval Patrick, signed the first proclamation commemorating Juneteenth in Massachusetts. Now, the Commonwealth will celebrate the day as an official state holiday this Saturday, also for the first time. Juneteenth, at its most elemental level, is a celebration, marking the day in 1865 that slavery came to an end in Texas. And of course, it's so much more than that, and we're going to dive into that powerful history with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Annette Gordon-Reed. She is a professor at Harvard, the author of numerous books, and that includes her latest on Juneteenth. And as we do that, we'd love to invite you into this conversation. How will you celebrate Juneteenth? What does the day mean to you here in New England? Also, what questions might you have for Annette Gordon-Reed? Call us. The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Professor Gordon-Reed, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Glad to be here.
So I know I gave the briefest of summaries of Juneteenth there in the introduction. So maybe you could beef that up for us a little bit. As a historian, what does Juneteenth mark?
Juneteenth marks June 19th, 1865, the day that United States Army General Gordon Granger came to Galveston, Texas, and issued General Order Number 3, which announced the end of slavery in Texas. And it was originally called Emancipation Day, but over the years, it became Juneteenth, and that's the way it's been celebrated for a very, very long time.
So now bring it here. Bring Juneteenth from Texas to New England. Why is something that started so locally elsewhere now so important locally here?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. As near as I have been able to determine, the holiday left Texas, came out of Texas, as Texans moved away from the state. The Texas diaspora introduced the holiday to places and around the country. And I think there has been a hunger for some day to commemorate the end of slavery. Now, this is not the total end of slavery. It was a process of emancipation. But I think the combination of proselytizing by Black Texans in the diaspora and also this desire to recognize this advance in human rights, the end of chattel slavery in this particular place, it caught on with people. It's a summer holiday. It's a family day. It's a day for barbecuing and fun. And as sort of a lead up to precursor to July 4th, it fits with this desire to recognize the end of slavery.
In your book on Juneteenth, you make this connection with sort of the evolution of the holiday and your evolution, if I may, in your understanding of the state you grew up in Texas, mm-hmm. your understanding yes. of its history, our collective need to understand its history. That is, as you've said, where the first Juneteenth was celebrated. So let's dig into that a little bit. And I think the first question for you is, what was Juneteenth to you growing up in Texas?
Well, growing up, it was primarily a fun family holiday that I look forward to. It was a day of drinking as much red soda water as we could contain for kids. And that's basically pop. Strawberry soda water, which is sort of one of the drinks that you're supposed to have some sort of red drink during Juneteenth. Eating barbecue, throwing firecrackers, lighting sparklers, just a day of fun. And as I got to be older, I understood more the serious nature of the holiday in the sense that it was something that you're commemorating the end of slavery. But as a kid, it was a mini family reunion and a time for community, you know, good spirits and good cheer.
Yeah, how do we make sense of that? This idea, as I'm hearing you talk about it, of something that is fraught with the import of history, but also for a child or a family, a moment of joy and celebration. As a historian, do we have a lot of those where it's both fraught and joyous? It's a big moment and also it's just a small, intimate celebration.
Not many things. I'm trying to think about the fourth has a different valence to it. I mean, the fourth, I suppose, is the day commemorates the beginning of the United States of America and the American Declaration of Independence. Juneteenth celebrates the end of slavery in Texas, but we know that it was a very difficult time after that for the enslaved people, because they were doing this celebrating in the midst of people who had been their former enslavers who were not so happy about all of that. So it was, I've said other places that it was a mixture of sort of hope and hostility, hope in the midst of hostility that you don't typically think of July 4th. July 4th, we can say, well, the Declaration didn't live up to all of its promises and so forth, but the United States of America was formed. The country did become a country. With Juneteenth, slavery ended, but another series of travails began. So it's a happy day. We can't minimize how those people felt when they learned that legalized slavery, in which they were you know, bought and sold, separated from their families, all those kinds of things no longer existed. But we are also mindful of the fact that this was the beginning of another set of struggles that the freed people had to endure.
You know, you said hope in the midst of hostility, and then you talked about another round of travails. And we were saying that, you know, a lot of this book is about your childhood. It was fascinating to learn that you were a childhood trailblazer, that you integrated a white school before it was court mandated. Sorry, I have trouble saying that word. And I expected more of a story of hope in the midst of hostility in that experience. But in many ways, you were naive of the experience that was happening around you.
Well, I knew it was a momentous thing. I knew from the way people talked about it that this was a big deal. But I grew up in a town where when I went to the doctor, there were separate waiting rooms for white people and black people. When I went to the movie with my brothers, we sat in the balcony. Black people had to sit in the balcony. So I understood the racial, I sort of experienced the living the way race, you know, was lived during that time period, even before I went to school. But I knew that there was something important about what I was doing. And I suppose I was, as a six-year-old, I wasn't aware of the worldwide implications of it, obviously, because I was of my age. But I was in a situation where I had a teacher, my first grade teacher, who was just wonderful to me. Some of the kids were nasty and some of the kids were nice. But I took all of that pretty much in stride. It was a difficult time in some ways, but I liked school. I liked learning things. I was a good student. And I don't wonder if I would have had a different time of it if I had not been a good student. In other words, if there had been other kinds of problems grafted onto the stresses of integrating a school. But for the most part, I would say I made it through without real trauma.
Listening out there, what questions do you have about the history of Juneteenth in Texas, what it means today for historian Annette Gordon Reed? The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So Annette, now we fast forward and your town celebrates you. There is a mural of you. There is a bust of you. They celebrate your Pulitzer Prize. They celebrate your Pulitzer Prize. How does it feel now to look back on that childhood, to be talking about our racial history in America, reflecting on things like Juneteenth, and now be celebrated in that very community?
Well, it feels good. I wish my parents were alive to see this. This would have meant a lot to them. But I'm also mindful of the fact that we still have a lot of problems. There's still issues in Texas and in other places about, voting, about what kind of history we can teach in schools. It's still part of a struggle in lots of ways. I mean, we've had advances, obviously. The fact that that people would honor me in that way suggests that that things have advanced, but there's still issues. And so you know, I'm happy about it, but I'm also mindful of the fact that Texas and other parts of the country right now are going through a lot as we try to figure out in the midst of what people have called a racial reckoning, what direction the country is going to take.
Let's unpack that a little bit. One of the references you just made there in that answer was to struggles over what people can teach in schools. And I was struck in your book where you talk about the idea that people may complain about revisionist history or mm-hmm. have criticism, might be a better word, that as we do projects like 1619, as we begin to look critically at the history we've taught ourselves and the way slavery, for example, is missing from it, Black contributions are missing from it, that somehow that's revising. You say no, that's completion in the book. Talk a little bit more about that.
Yes, I mean, revisionist history, people use that term in a pejorative sort of way. But what they're not realizing is that history is always being revised constantly. Every good historian is a revisionist historian in the sense that new information comes to light and you have to write things differently in light of that, of the new information gleaned. Different people ask different questions about material. Some people could look at a document, say the Texas, the Constitution of the Republic of Texas, that has many provisions talking about race, in which they basically, the state has a full-throated support for the institution of slavery, which says that Black people, people of African descent, can't become citizens. They can't come to the state and reside there without permission, all those kinds of things. People could read that document. Some historians, and some historians did read it, and they may not have thought anything about those provisions. But there's no way now that people looking at that document would not take note of those provisions and not see that it helped to shape Texas and shape Texans and their experiences in the state. So we're attuned to those things now and we pay attention to them. And so history is always being revised because, as I said, every generation has its own questions about the past. And because we find out new things and we want to incorporate those new things into the story.
So let's bring that back home here again. You know, we're in New England. We love the opportunity here to talk about Plymouth. Last year on our show, we marked the 400th anniversary. I'm chuckling because you addressed that in the book, and I heard your chuckle about that, too. We marked the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower's arrival last year by looking more deeply into the history of the Indigenous people here then, here now. You talk about that narrative a bit in the book, why the narrative has persisted. Why has it that America started with the arrival of Puritan pilgrims here in 1620?
Well, it's a more uplifting, I guess, in some ways, but a more uplifting story about people coming to escape religious persecution. Communities, family, religion, all those kinds of things. But it's a more uplifting story than, say, Jamestown, which is a story where people are coming essentially to make money and where they very quickly began to institute a system of plantation of slavery. And, you know, Jamestown obviously is before Plymouth. And as I talk in the book, you know, Florida and St. Augustine is before both of them, well before both of them. The Spanish are here and doing all kinds of things. But Plymouth gives you a, if you leave out the Native American part, which people did for the longest period of time, other than the story of Thanksgiving, it's a better story than Jamestown, where people are just there to make money and there's no... there's no higher power, no higher thing that they're trying to recur to. So that's a preferable start to the narrative.
You know, you talk about that so often in the book, this idea that what we hunger for is the mythological story, the better story that we can rally around. And as a result, in our telling of stories and our sort of worshiping is too strong a word, but we'll use it for now, our worshiping of historical figures, we embrace an incomplete picture because it's a better story and it's less complex. What do we lose when we do that? You know, there's real implication to that in the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves.
Well, because you lose reality. You lose a sense of what's really going on in a place. It's a bit of essential information. It's like you're trying to put something together. And there are ingredients that are missing from it. And here you don't really know why certain things are happening. You don't have a sense of the origins of things. You know, it may not be, the stories of the past may not all be pleasant and they're not always going to be present if you're dealing with them realistically, but at least they give you, they tell you the condition of your society. They give you a sense of why we are doing these kinds of things. And you can't help to fix, it's sort of hard to fix things if you don't know, really don't understand the nature of the problem. So mythology, and I do talk a little bit about this, and it's not just Americans who do this. All societies have their myths. And that sort of suggests that this may be something that we need at some level, but we also need history, and we have to be realistic about the past if we have any hope of figuring out who we are and doing better for the future.
You know, so I said at the very beginning of our conversation that the Commonwealth will celebrate Juneteenth as an official state holiday this Saturday for the first time. What is the potential of that in the moment we are in, a year after the murder of George Floyd, several years into protests again and reckoning again with our racial history? What is the potential for communities observing Juneteenth?
Well, the potential is that people will do what I was saying before. Think about how we got here. Why do we have these kinds of problems? Where did this come from? And people have to understand that Juneteenth, 1865, was not so long ago, really. I mean, I knew my great-grandmother, who lived till I was about 11. Her mother had been born in slavery and had been freed as a child by her father, who owned her and her mother. My grandmother, my great-grandmother knew her, my grandmother knew her, and I knew them. So I know people who knew people who had been enslaved. And so these things are not so long ago. And I think Juneteenth, celebrating Juneteenth and thinking about that will help us sort of draw the lines, not one line, but to think about how we have arrived at a point where we have racial problems, that we have a system of racial hierarchy that we've been chipping away at for most of the 20th century and part of the 21st century through law and education and all of those things. And we've made some progress, but it would make us think about, we still have a way to go here. So this holiday invites us to think about the legacies of the past, and, you know, doing that in the summer. I know there will be celebrations, but it's also a time for education, which people are trying to do as well.
Annette Gordon-Reed is a university professor at Harvard, Pulitzer Prize-winning author. Her latest book is on Juneteenth. Professor Gordon-Reed, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.